Well, thanks for the, well, I don't know exactly who to thank for letting me speak here. but I guess I should thank my fellow organizers for giving me a chance. So this is work, I'm going to talk about work done with a couple of graduate students, Dan Gulata and Sylvia Pufu, and an undergrad even, J.P. Ang. And some of what I'm going to tell you is in these somewhat older papers, and a lot of what I'm going to mention today has not yet appeared. It should appear, I hope. I don't know. I thought it was going to appear last Friday. Maybe it will appear next Friday. Who knows? It's mostly done, but I'm trying to fix some things up. So those of you who haven't asked me already are probably wondering what my title is. I apologize. It's a bad pun. I'm going to be talking about supersymmetric Chern-Simons theory. So that's the CST. With an ADE classification of sorts. So they're gonna have some sort of. And so by ADE classification, more specifically, I have in mind some gauge theories which are going to be described by a quiver. And the quiver is basically going to be a simply laced affine Dinkin diagram. But if those words don't mean anything, they'll mean something, I hope, as we go along. So let me begin with some motivation. Sean gave me about 15 minutes to come up with a title last week, and I did the best I could in limited resources. So motivation. I guess most broadly, I can say the following. So why study Suzy gauge theories, supersymmetric gauge theories in 2+1 dimensions? Well, maybe they'll help us learn about some general features of gauge theories, or of gauge theories in 2+1 dimensions. And why study gauge theories in 2+1 dimensions? Well, maybe I can draw some tenuous connection with the workshop here. I know there are a number of condensed matter systems. Maybe I shouldn't go so far. Maybe I should just say many body systems or lattice models with emergent gauge symmetries at low temperature. And so, you know, there's sort of this grand hope here behind some of what I'm going to say today. I'm not really going to make a whole lot of progress in following this list of implications. Maybe there's some long-term goal here in saying something about real-world systems. But let me be a little bit more specific. This is a fairly general statement. Let me be a little bit more specific. There's a new tool. It's developed, well, maybe it's not quite so new anymore. Maybe it's developed almost a year and a half or 2 years ago. There's a matrix model, which is going to be a key character in the discussion today, that was developed by Kapustin and a couple of his graduate students, Kapustin, Willett, and Yakov. I think this is a paper from December of 2009. Where they showed that you can reduce the partition function of one of these supersymmetric Chern-Simons theories on an S3. Okay, so it's a Euclidean partition function. It's a bit of a strange partition function. A partition function on a 3-sphere instead of a partition function that involves time. Add a superconformal fixed point. That this partition function reduces to a matrix model. Instead of, you know, integrating over all your fields and over all space and time, you can reduce this complicated partition function by a localization argument to a simple matrix integral. So, good. So it's you need, I believe, at least n equals 2 in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And you also, I believe, need this conformal symmetry. You need to be at a fixed point. So why is this interesting? Why is this neutral interesting? Well, one argument that's usually put out at the beginning of papers on the subject is that you can provide now quantitative tests of dualities. So many of you probably know that we have these anomalies in 3 plus 1 dimensional gauge theories, or 1 plus 1 dimensional, but in 2 plus 1, these odd dimensional field theories, we don't have anomalies. And in the past, these anomalies provided great tests for these dualities in 3 plus 1 dimensional theories. We didn't have a similar tool in 2 plus 1, but this provides you a way of testing these dualities quantitatively. For example, there are generalized Seiberg dualities for these 2 plus 1 dimensional theories that you can test. And you can also even say something about the origin of my bad pun about ADS-CFT dualities. You can check ADS-CFT using this new tool. So it's I think a reasonably big development here. And there's also the superconformal index, which can play a similar role. There's been a lot of motion in the field recently, where people have been busy calculating these partition functions and superconformal indices and thinking about how they bear out these conjectured dualities for 2 plus 1 dimensional theories. And I can talk a little bit about my personal motivation and how I got started in this, which is really related to this ADS-CFT connection. So there was another paper, which is a little bit more recent. I guess this is Strucker, Marino, and Putra from July of 2010. And what did they show? They showed that if you calculated this partition function, log ZS3, this is my partition function on a 3-sphere, it has an n to the 3/2 scaling. What is n? And for a particular theory, so the particular theory is where this n shows up. If you look at the fixed point for maximally supersymmetric UN Yang-Mills theory in 2 plus 1 dimensions. At its IR fixed point, this is also often called the ABJM theory. If you look at this maximally SUSY UN Yang-Mills theory, and you look in the limit of large n, then you find that this partition function from this matrix model, so this is an exact field theory calculation, has this n to the 3/2 scaling. So why is that interesting? Why did this get me excited? Well, this is I guess it's almost a 15-year-old prediction by ADS-CFT. There's a very early paper, in fact, predated ADS-CFT by Klebanov and Saitlin, where they were calculating from black hole solutions in 11-dimensional supergravity, calculating some thermal free energies or something that looked like it should be a thermal free energy for a 2 plus 1 dimensional theory. And they saw this end of the 3/2 scaling. Later, afterwards, when we have ADS-CFT, after Juan's paper, there's sort of a more precise statement of what Drucker, Marino, and Putrev were showing. There's a later paper by Emperon, Myers, or Johnson, where at this point it was clear that the relevant field theory dual to this gravity construction was this IR fixed point of this maximally supersymmetric UN Yang-Mills theory. And Emperon, Myers, and Johnson actually used ADS-CFT to calculate precisely this free energy, And they saw this end of the 3/2 scaling. And so, now 15 years later, we have a field theory confirmation of this ADS-CFT prediction. That was pretty exciting last year. And you say, well, I don't really care about partition functions on the Euclidean 3-sphere. But ADS-CFT, it's telling you a little bit more than that. If you believe ADS-CFT, then the scale of the supergravity action, this 11-dimensional supergravity action. It sets not only this free energy, three-sphere free energy, but it sets a lot of other quantities as well. It sets the thermal free energy. It sets things like entropy. If you believe ADS-CFT, this end of the three-half scaling is just a consequence of the overall scale of the supergravity action. So it's you're seeing sort of justification you're seeing an exact field theory argument for this end of the three halves, which is true not just for this three-sphere partition function, but if you believe ADS-CFT, it's also going to hold for entropies and thermal free energies and a whole bunch of other quantities. I'm being a little brief because I assume that many of you have seen things like this before, but if not, then feel free to ask questions. This is the end of my motivation. So very general, somewhat more specific, and where I got into the subject. Yeah, John.
Well, is something you include sources of function?
Yeah, good. So actually, when Kapustin and Willett and Yakov wrote this down, I think they were most interested in computing expectation values of various supersymmetric operators. So one thing you can use is you can look at a certain class of supersymmetric Wilson loops with this matrix model, and also compute their expectation value exactly. Is that what you meant, or? But they have to preserve some supersymmetry, or else this localization argument fails. Yeah, Gary.
If I remember correctly, AB, J, and M had in their paper some heuristic arguments why this end of the three halves might come out of the theory. Does the exact calculation confirm those heuristic arguments in any sense, or is it just totally an independent argument?
I don't remember these arguments very well. I guess I should go back and look at them, but I guess I didn't think they were convincing.
Yeah.
Right. So this is one sort of unfortunate aspect of the localization procedure. It's a fairly big deformation of your original action. That's what lets you reduce it to a matrix model. And so after you perform this localization procedure, it's not completely it's not clear what the microscopic degrees of freedom in the gauge theory were. I can tell you exactly how it comes about from the matrix model, and I can also cite there's a recent paper by Marino and Putra, came out last week, who are arguing for some sort of Fermi liquid explanation of this end of the three halves. I suspect it's also very closely tied to the matrix model. It doesn't really come out directly from the field theory, but it's sort of a different take on the end of the three halves. Other questions? So let me move on then. Let me give you a brief outline of what I want to do today. I mean, the basic idea, extend the class of field theories we can consider from just this maximally supersymmetric U and Yang-Mills theory. I'm going to look at a larger class of field theories to try and address this question that Eva raised, maybe indirectly and maybe ultimately not so successfully. If we can see more generally how this end to the three halves arises, maybe we can learn a little bit about what's happening in the field theory. And another way of saying what I want to do is I want to really pick apart the matrix model at large n to see what's happening. Really understand this matrix model as well as we can at large n to see what's going on. My outline. I want to remind you. I want to remind you of where this end of the three halves comes from gravity. Briefly, I want to tell you about this ADE classification that's going to arise from the matrix model considerations. I want to briefly describe how the end of the three halves comes from the matrix model. And then at the end, I want to tell you a neat fact about, you know, in line of picking apart this matrix model, what it's actually doing, a connection between the matrix model and operator counting. So that's my plan.
Your relation to the matrix model doesn't depend on our
No, that's correct. That's correct. This matrix model is going to be correct at any n, which is actually a very interesting thing to take advantage of if you're interested in one of our n corrections in ADS-CFT. This is a place where you can start to compute those. But I'm not going to have anything to say about that today.
There are no subleading corrections to n to 3/2.
There are subleading corrections to n to the 3/2. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the ideas behind this recent paper I was just citing is to think about how to get at those efficiently. All right, so n to the 3/2 from gravity. Let me try and remind you where this comes from, if you've forgotten. So ADS-CFT predicts the following. Predicts there are going to be CFTs to certain solutions in 11-dimensional supergravity, dual to ADS4 cross Y. So this is just a cross product as opposed to Larian's fiber product yesterday, where this Y is a 7-dimensional manifold. And I'm in 11-dimensional supergravity. And these solutions are supported by flux, so-called four-form flux, F4. And so what do we know about these solutions? We know that for CFTs with, but these are two plus one-dimensional CFTs with more than or greater than or equal to 2 supersymmetry, this Y has certain special properties. It's what's known as Sasaki-Einstein, the 7 manifold. If you don't remember what Sasaki-Einstein is, maybe you do know what a Calabi-Yau is. Probably know what a Calabi-Yau is. I can just define Y as the base of some Calabi-Yau, 8-dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold that's also a cone, so it's got some sort of radial scaling symmetry. And there's a nice picture that people often draw here, which maybe I'll sketch. Maybe I'll sketch. If you think of some stack of M2 brains, which is where this field theory, this 2 plus 1-dimensional field theory is living. So here's my n M2s. And I have my Calabi-Yau cone X, and this level surface is Y. And you know, what happens, you put this big stack of M2 brains in this geometry, and you get some back reaction. You get this nice ADS4 cross Y solution. All right. So where does the end of the 3/2 come from? What's a nice, simple argument for where it comes from? So there must be some that four-form flux, where is it coming from? It's coming from, morally at least, these n M2 brains. So there's some sort of flux quantization condition on this four-form flux that's satisfied. And the flux quantization condition is that if I take the integral of a sort of dual magnetic, Hodge dual seven-form flux, sort of the magnetic flux dual to this F4, this has got to be quantized in some way. So I know it, basically by dimensional analysis, this thing has units of length to the sixth, and the only scale I have here in 11-dimensional supergravity is the Planck length. So the way this is going to be quantized, I have n M2 brains, I have one length scale, which is this Planck length. So what sits on the right-hand side is n times L Planck to the sixth. But I also know something else. There's some radius of curvature associated with these spaces. Let's call it L. There's some radius of curvature of the Andy de Sitter space of this Sasaki-Einstein manifold Y. Let's call it L. I also know that in terms of the supergravity solution, this is going to scale as L to the sixth power. Again, just by dimensional analysis, it's the sometimes the only scale it can sit there. What else do I know? So if I think about G Newton, and these backgrounds, well, I do a little bit more dimensional analysis. I know that G Newton in 11 dimensions has to scale as a Planck length to the 11th, ninth, to the ninth power. That's the way it is. It's the way you do a simple calculation using the Riemann Einstein-Hilbert action. This comes out very simply. So this is true in 11 dimensions. And the last thing I know is that if I write down my supergravity action, which is going to determine a lot of these dual field theory quantities, the supergravity action, let's call it S sugra, it's going to scale as 1 over G Newton.
Okay.
So I assemble these facts together. This is, you know, L Planck to the minus ninth power, and I can rewrite it in terms of n. The only place that n is going to appear is through its, you know, relation to the Planck length. And what I find here is n to the 3 halves. The supergravity action scales is n to the 3 halves. So that means a lot of things. It means that the free energy on the 3 sphere is going to be n to the 3 halves. It means that the thermal energy is going to be n to the 3 halves. It means the entropy is going to be n to the 3 halves. Lots of quantities for these field theories are going to scale with this n. Okay. Questions about that? Wanted to review briefly where this n to the 3 halves comes from the gravity side. So the next thing I want to embark on is a more careful discussion of this matrix model. And you know, eventually we'll see how the n to the 3 halves comes from the matrix model. But before that, we're going to come to some sort of classification of Chern-Simons theories that we can deal with using this matrix model. OK, so A to E classification. So I want to restrict to a fairly small class of Chern-Simons theories. I want to look at the following. I want to look at n equals 3 supersymmetric Chern-Simons theories. Okay, so one more supercharged one. A little bit more supersymmetry than the minimal I would need to use this matrix model. And I want to restrict to a certain class of gauge groups. I guess I'm not exactly sure how to motivate this. Maybe this is part of the motivation is I know what kinds of, in the 3 plus 1 dimensional field theory case and duals to ADS5, I know what kinds of field theories often show up in these pairs. And I know one particular simple class is when I assume the gauge group has some sort of product structure, just a product of unitary groups, product of UNAs. And I also want to assume a special kind of matter content. I want to assume that the matter content all of the matter content transforms in bifundamental representations. Bifundamental representations of let's call this G of G. So, say a fundamental of one of these UN groups and an anti-fundamental of some other UN group. Yeah, Shaman.
So if X is a Calabi-Yau 4 fold, you generally get n equals 2. So, is there a way to summarize on the geometric side what leads to n equals 3?
Oh, good question. Yeah. So, what happens since as Shams put it, I'm using n equals 3. What happens here is that instead of having a Calabi-Yau, which implies n equals 2, I'm going to get a hyperkähler. I'm going to get a hyperkähler space. X is hyper-Taylor would imply N equals 3. I don't think so. It may also, but it, I know examples which have N equals 3 and where the moduli space is hyper-Taylor. This nice paper by Jeff Ferris and Tomasiello, for example, where they examine this particular case. It also implies something for Y. Y actually gets an extra qualifier. It's known as tri-Sasaki Einstein for the experts in this case. More questions? Okay, so this is a fairly restrictive class of gauge theories, and you might object at this point that you're no longer interested. You want to consider some more general class, but I claim this gives us enough structure. The answer is going to be worth making these assumptions. Okay, so I can summarize the content of these assumptions in the following way. I'll be able to draw my gauge theory using something called a quiver. So for each circle here or node, I have a gauge group. We can label them, say, N1, N2, N3, N4. And for each edge, I have a bifundamental field. Let's call it X. AB, which transforms in, say, the anti-fundamental of N1 and the fundamental of N2. And I also get another one. I get a sort of an arrow going the other direction, XBA, which would transform in the fundamental of N1 and the anti-fundamental of N2.
Is it important for you that it's a tree?
No, not at this point. This is supposed to be just some sort of general. I'm going to give you an example of the kinds of theories that arise with these assumptions. Okay. Okay, so the matrix model for this kind of theory is relatively straightforward to write down. So the claim of KWI, there's no reason to disbelieve it, which they argued by this localization argument, I can write down a matrix model. And so the eigenvalues are, I'm going to label them lambda AI. They're eigenvalues of the so-called auxiliary scalar in the vector multiplet. So A would run over the gauge groups just as it did over there, and I would run over the eigenvalues for each gauge group. So I would run from 1 up to NA. Okay, so let me see if I can write this down in a reasonable way. So ZS3, the sort of miraculous claim of Kapustin-Miletnyakov, is at that partition function, is the following eigenvalue integral. So I integrate over the eigenvalues. I have an LV for the vector multiplets. And I've got an LM for the matter fields or bifundamentals or hypermultiplets, whatever you want to call them. Okay? So that's the schematic form of the So if you want, right, I can replace the eigenvalues with, I guess, some matrix. Why do they all commute? I guess because they're in different sort of. There really is just one matrix. I mean, there's the matrix. I can think of some huge group G, and it's the eigenvalues of that. Okay, so let me write L down LV and LM, just so you see what they look like. I'm not really going to use them. So I have some product of the gauge groups, some sort of normalization, and then somewhat complicated expression involving hyperbolic trig functions. And something that comes from the Chern-Simons term in the original action. Uh-oh. Sum on A, KA, lambda, AI squared. Okay, that's the vector, and then there's a matter field, which is going to look like a product over edges in the quiver, a product over pairs of eigenvalues, and another hyperbolic trig function.
Yeah. Are there any free parameters in these theories?
Are there free parameters? Oh, you know, I forgot to write down the Chern-Simons levels. Those are kind of free. So I'm going to get a Chern-Simons level for each gauge group. But basically, aside from that, the I think the Lagrangian is fixed by the supersymmetry, the superpotential, and so forth.
Those k's appear in the partition function.
These are the Chern-Simons levels. These are the Chern-Simons levels. Good.
Sorry, what does V and M refer to here?
So V is gauge field or vector multiplet. V stands for vector and M stands for matter. Where does this come from? So In the Kapustin-Yakov matrix model, what happens is that you basically reduce the partition function to some sort of saddle point. And there's a tree level contribution to that saddle point integral, which is basically just the Chern-Simons term. And then there's a one loop contribution. There's a one loop contribution, which is basically the rest, these two things. And why am I calling this vector and this matter? Well, this depends on differences within a gauge group. The gauge index here is A and A. And it came from integrating out the vectors. And here I have an A minus B, so I'm looking at edges or hypers, and it came from integrating out the matter fields.
And
the claim is that this is an exact result for the partition function because of this localization argument.
Are you going to say more about the matrix model itself?
No.
It's just a black box.
So
we'll add something to the action that makes the path localize.
You add an exact, Q-exact term to the action.
So this is really an index, by the way, not a partition function. It's something that's invariant under superspecific deformations, right?
It is the partition function on an S3.
But not the partition.
Not with the minus one to the f.
And that's invariant on your partition function. That's what I said. Oh, you say you're adding out a suit. You're adding a BRST exactly.
I'm not sure how to answer these questions.
This is why you need superconformal.
I think this is why I need superconformal symmetry. Yeah, maybe Kapustin is not that far away. Probably a better person to answer these questions. Yeah.
Can you actually evaluate correlation functions of operators in the BRST cohomology then in the matrix model also?
I don't know the answer to that. My understanding is I can calculate expectation values of Wilson loops, but I suspect the answer is no. Yeah, for purposes of this talk, this is going to be a black box.
But you sort of explained what it was in the field. It's the D field and the sloop and the vector multiple.
It's the, if you think about the gauge theories coming from four dimensions, when you compactify the gauge field, you get this extra scalar from the extra dimension, and that's...
Well, it's a dynamical scalar, it's not a
D. It's often called sigma.
Sorry, I missed it.
I thought that was the nomenclature. Maybe I should cross it out. All right, so Poustin got this from a saddle point, and I'm going to evaluate it in the large n limit, and so I'm basically going to do another saddle point on top of this saddle point. Unfortunately, this extra saddle point I'm going to do is only exact in the large n limit. So, I'm going to look at the saddle point approximation, and I'm going to assume that I can write NA in terms of some little NAs of order 1 times some big N, where N is much, much greater than 1. So those big NAs, right, are the ranks of the gauge groups, and I'm assuming they're all large in some sense. So this is an additional saddle point on top of the one that Kapustin, Lill, and Yakov took. So we have an ansatz for the eigenvalue distribution, which was suggested by numerics, which seems to work rather well in a fairly generic situation. And the ansatz is the following, that I can write that the eigenvalues condense along curves in the complex plane. And I can describe those curves in the following way, with the following sort of large N scaling. There's some real part, which is basically the same for all the eigenvalues, and then some imaginary part, which is order 1. And there'll be higher order corrections, of course, to this. But at leading order in N, this is all we need to worry about. So the idea here is that for each gauge group, I'm going to have I goes from 1 to NA curves, separate curves for the eigenvalues. And then each gauge group has some set of curves, and the number of curves in each set is NA. Okay. And the real part is going to grow with some positive power of N, so the eigenvalues spread out along the x-axis. And the imaginary part is going to stay bounded and of order 1. So this is, where did we get this? Well, we wrote some code to evaluate the saddle point numerically, and we observed this behavior. So it seems like a reasonable starting point for what to plug into the matrix integral. Okay, so one interesting point about this, right, is that there's going to be an eigenvalue density. Let's call it rho of x. Which is independent of A and I. It's the same for all the eigenvalues. By not putting any indices here in the real part, I'm getting the same eigenvalue density for all the curves. Sort of strange feature of the results, but this is what the numeric suggests. Okay. So this is our ansatz, the answer. And what happens, if we look at the leading term in the saddle point equation for the eigenvalues. So that, you know, we have to just basically solve some sort of force condition on the eigenvalues, that the forces between the eigenvalues all balance out. The leading term in that force equation is the following. It's 2NA minus the sum on the edges such that some of the edges containing A and B, okay, and then some other junk that doesn't look like it's going to vanish at all. Dx prime sine x minus x prime Row of x prime. This is a leading term in my saddle point equation. And this is better vanish. I've got to satisfy the saddle point equation. You notice that there's some long-range forces here between the eigenvalues. This is an integral, right? So eigenvalues far away from x, these eigenvalues x prime far away from x are influencing how much force that eigenvalue at x feels, which is kind of an inconvenient aspect in physics. It's nice to have local forces. But even beyond that, if I want this term to vanish, I need the following condition, basically, to be satisfied. I basically need qna equal to the sum on edges containing a of all of these nb's. I need this condition. This condition will imply that the long-range forces vanish. The Chern-Simons levels? I haven't made any assumption about the levels yet. This tree level term is actually subleading at this point in the large N expansion. They show up at lower order. Yeah. So there's sort of an inversion here between the one loop and tree level. Okay, so let me try and make this condition look a little bit more familiar. If I think about the number of colors and the number of flavors for this eighth gauge group, what this is really saying is it's saying that, get the two in the right place, it's saying the number of flavors is twice the number of colors. I think of the bifundamental fields as some sort of flavor fields for the eighth gauge group. Okay. So this is actually a very interesting condition, and some of you may already, mathematicians in there, may already recognize it. It's saying something about the quivers, right? It's saying something about what kind of quivers are allowed that have this nice long-range force cancellation condition. And what is it saying? It's basically saying that the quiver must be simply laced affine Dinkin diagram. It must have this ADE classification. So you get quivers that look like the following, right? You get an A1 quiver, you get an A2 quiver, and you get D4, et cetera, et cetera. You get quivers that look like this. But there's not a finite number of them, but there's an innumerable number of them that have this ADE classification. That's quite remarkable. Make a few more comments about this. One is what this condition would mean in 4D. So in 4D, this NF equals 2NC. The sort of conformal dimensions or R charges implied by supersymmetry, it would imply the vanishing of the NFZZ beta function. Of course, I don't have an NFZZ beta function in 2 plus 1 dimensions, so I don't quite know why this condition is showing up here. Exactly where this came from, but it's suggestive. Yeah, well, they better be in order for this matrix model to work. I guess a priori, I don't necessarily know that they have this fixed point. But I mean, one possible interpretation is that there is some sort of analog of this beta function in 2 plus 1, and I need this condition in order to have the superconformal fixed point in order for this sort of setup to work. But I don't know that for sure. I'm not sure that at all, right? But just suggested. And I can make another comment about this. So there's a paper by Gaiato and Witten. I think it's probably the longest one. where they call such quivers balanced. They call such quivers balanced. One issue here, though, is that they were looking at quivers with where the KAs were set to zero. They were looking at quivers with n equals 4 supersymmetry. So they were looking at not Trans-Simon theories, but regular gauge theories in 2 plus 1 dimensions. And if the quiver is balanced, then some nice things happen. There's an enhancement of the global symmetries in the Coulomb branch of moduli space. So in this context, though, I don't know exactly what the significance is, because they didn't look at quivers with non-zero Trans-Simon levels. So if you have comments about either of these points, I'd love to hear them.
Well, so locality in the eigenvalue space is kind of related to locality in space time through what you just said about the scalar.
Is that true? I don't know.
Words like familiar idiosyncratic examples, moving the eigenvalues, just like moving around the cone you drew.
Right.
You know of field theories which don't behave locally in that multiple space deformation. Tails. Lines.
I see. So you're saying that if... that could be. So that the... If there was some sort of non-locality in the matrix model, it would suggest some sort of non-local behavior in the moduli space, which would imply some more complicated moduli space than just this Trisasaki cone or something different anyway.
These eigenvalues are not of the scalars in the gauge theory. These are eigenvalues of some auxiliary field in the gauge multiple, right?
That's right.
Wait, we just talked about this. You said it was a scalar
in the vector multiplet.
Is it the thing whose moduli space was the Trisasaki space to begin with? I thought those would be matter multiples.
Usually the way I think about this is I integrate... I usually think of the moduli space in terms of the bifundamental fields.
Those have been multiple.
And those have been integrated out in the matrix model. So it's sort of a confusing connection.
What direction is this?
It's not clear to me.
Is it just one of the directions of the base of the cone?
This auxiliary scalar expectation value?
Yeah, you're down in 2 plus 1, right? So,
this is a good question. Maybe some more precise connection can... I don't know what the connection is, but maybe one can make a more precise connection there.
And this condition that you thought is just a condition for the consistency or for some niceness of your ansatz, right? Is it clear that there isn't some other solution?
No. This is quite a restrictive ansatz, right? And maybe if I weaken the condition that the real parts were all the same, for instance, I might be able to find more general solutions.
Do you have any condition of the true time plus?
I'm getting there.
Okay.
Maybe I should go on. But this was the end of the ADE classification. And one more comment I guess I can make is that before I close the book on this is that there are more examples if you allow for other kinds of gauge groups. If you allow for SO and SP, I suspect, we haven't really worked this out, you can find more general examples of these quivers which satisfy this long-range force cancellation condition. Okay. Right. So, third part of the talk, end of the three halves from field theory, end of the three halves from field theory. So, claim is the following. So, if you use this ansatz, which I just erased, and you do some algebra, you can compute the saddle point value of the free energy, by which I mean negative log absolute value ZS3. And maybe I should actually take out the... Maybe I don't actually mean these absolute values yet. I'm a little bit confused about the reality properties of this free energy. Let me just take those out.
That's another question. Is it known? So the trick of the quiver here determines which Trisasaki Einstein space you get. Do you know whether there's something bad in the Trisasaki space if you don't think it's just?
That's another good question. I haven't looked at this carefully. I mean, I know the cone is some hyperkähler quotient construction.
That's true whatever quiver I pick.
And that should be true with whatever quiver I pick, but maybe there's something. Yeah, it seems unlikely, right? It seems like the problem is more subtle, that I can construct lots of these hyperkähler quotients, but only certain of them come from these field theories. I know. All right, so let me write out the saddle point. So I claim you can calculate this with a finite amount of work. It's relatively straightforward. There's a contribution to the free energy from the tree level term, from that Chern-Simons term, which looks like n to the 1 plus 2 alpha. So remember, alpha was the scaling of the real part with n of the eigenvalues, sum on n a k a x squared dx. And then there's another term, 2n to the 1 plus alpha, sum on a k a x y bar a. Let me define y bar a in a minute. I don't want two dx's. And then there's a one loop term, pi n to the 2 minus alpha integral rho x squared, and then some mess here. Sum on a squared over 4 minus sum on the edges n a and b y a bar b bar squared dx. And what do I mean by y bar? I basically mean an average of the imaginary parts of the eigenvalues.
And why are there imaginary parts anyway?
This is a good question. I don't know exactly where they should come from or why they should be there.
What they are.
I mean, in principle, you ought to be able to match them with supergravity. Maybe there's some, you know, the 11-dimensional supergravity action does have this Chern-Simons term, and you make it Euclidean. Maybe there's some I there.
But you also have complex saddles for the eigenvalues.
I do have complex saddle points for the eigenvalues. So maybe I should sum up more than one saddle point, and the real parts cancel. Could be two. I don't have a good answer to this. Good question. Right. Okay. So, and this is actually, well, yeah. Let's just leave it at that. Okay. So this is what you get. And so the first part comes from the Chern-Simons term, the tree level term. And the second part comes from this one loop or the matter fields, so on and so forth.
And alpha is some number that, if you know the quiver.
And alpha, remember, it's part of my ansatz. I was saying the real part of the eigenvalues were growing. Let me write it down again. So lambda a was supposed to be n to the alpha x plus iy.
Where x is of order 1.
Where x is of order 1 and y is of order 1, right?
Oh. As long as the alpha is the same.
Yeah.
Determine.
I'm about to. So in order to have a saddle point, I need to balance two of these terms against each other. And so there are a couple of possibilities. One is that 1 plus 2 alpha is 2 minus alpha, in which case alpha is a third. And the other possibility is that I can restrict the Chern-Simons levels. I can say that sum on NAKA equals 0, okay? In which case, the first term in the tree level part vanishes, and I can set 1 plus alpha equal to 2 minus alpha, in which case alpha is 1 half. Okay. Two cases, 1 and 2. And if I plug in those values for alpha, in the first case, I get f going as n to the 5 thirds, and in the second case, I get f going as n to the 3 halves. And okay, so this is the case people usually study. This is the case with the 11-dimensional supergravity dual. This is the case, for example, that includes ABJM theory, where the Chern-Simons levels satisfy this restriction. this case, it seems like it might have a massive, massive type 2A description. So this is 11 dimensions, 11 dimensional supergravity. And this will have a massive type 2A. At least that's the conjecture. It has the right n scaling to have, just by this sort of same sort of dimensional analysis argument I ran at the beginning of the talk, to have a massive type 2A dual. And I've lied a little bit, because if you really want to get the massive type 2A dual, you have to take a slightly different ansatz. But the alpha counting is good.
Can you explain about that comment? I mean, massive type 2A means you add an F naught to the other regions that you already have. But the scaling to the different terms that you gave before would still hold. And now you'd add some F naught term that you would want to scale the same as the original term. Does the F naught term dominate over one of the original terms to give you the
different terms? I haven't done the calculations. Maybe I'm being a bit too quick. Maybe I should actually do it and then tell you how it works.
Well, I think it would have to be true that you change the scaling relative to your previous argument. The F naught term would have to be
important.
Replace one of the other terms.
Yeah.
Maybe that's true.
But also, I mean, in type 2A, the scaling is different also. I mean, this is some sort of like weak coupling limit, in which case the free energy doesn't go as n to the 3 halves, it goes as n squared.
You have some k
depends
on the original ABJ. So
in the second case, the reason that you could ignore the tree level term and solving your solid problem is because you're actually going to set it to 0. That's the reason the one-limit term appears first. Is that correct?
The reason that this, sorry. Oh.
The reason that you started by analyzing just the one-limit terms was because secretly later you're going to set the zero and the two-limit terms.
Only one of them.
Only one of them. This is still sub-leading to what I wrote down before. I think what I wrote down before is order n. The long-range forces are order n. And this, I was assuming alpha is greater than zero. So this has got to be sub-leading.
If alpha is zero, there's no saddle point.
If alpha is zero, there's no saddle point, I think. Okay. So that's n to the 3 halves. How much time do I have? I'm the organizer, huh? You make me suffer. I was going to show you a nice result about operator counting. But maybe I should just skip that in view of the time and just tell you a few things that we did that I don't have time to cover, and a few things that we're thinking of doing, and just wrap up there. And you know, those who want to hear more, ask. Stay later. So other things we did. And I should probably point out, I mean, one reason I didn't do this calculation is that I'm not really responsible for this observation. This was noticed in a paper by Silviu and Igor and Jeff Harris and Ben Safdie. Other things we did. So there's this nice relation. There's a nice relation between the eigenvalue distribution and operator counts and the chiral ring, which I was going to tell you about, which I don't think I have time to do. It's not quite, because I don't quite know where. I don't have a constructive argument for why this relationship is true. It's more of an observation than anything else. You can think about this generalized Seiberg duality. At large n. There's some nice papers now where I believe there's a proof that this partition function is invariant under Seiberg duality for general n. But they're kind of complicated. They rely on some sophisticated math PhD theses and identities of hyperelliptic gamma functions. the story here at large n is a bit simpler and nice. You can also explore the connection to my Trisasaki space to Y in greater detail. We did this for the AN quivers, and there's a really nice story which involves a polygon and a toric hyperkähler spaces, which are actually not toric, but and operator counting. So those are three things that I think are quite nice that you can do with this set of examples that I don't have time to tell you about.
Is operator counting the same as state counting?
I mean, you look at operators in the chiral ring, so again, traces of these bifundamental fields, you concatenate them together and you make gauge invariant words, modulo, superpotential relations, and you count them. You see how many operators of this form are there which have R charge less than 10 and monopole charge less than 2, and you can relate that number to the eigenvalue distribution. That's what I mean. And again, maybe after I end, I'd be happy to go into greater detail about what exactly that is. But in ending, I think what I want to do is I just want to tell you a little bit about things that we're thinking of doing, things to do. We only looked at AN and B4. And we got a little bit tired, but I think in the future we may try and look at all of ADE in general and see what happens. And it seems like there might be an expression like the Weyl character formula. For F, for the free energy. It might be an expression like the Weyl character formula for F. And if you can write it in this way, if you can write it as some sort of sum over the Weyl group of the ADE-Dinkin diagram, it would make this Seiberg duality manifest, which I think would be quite nice. Because Seiberg duality for these ADE quivers, it's basically a reflection in the Weyl group. It's basically an action of the Weyl group. So if you can write some expression which is a sum over the Weyl group or something that's manifestly invariant over the Weyl group, you'd see the Seiberg duality quite explicitly. And we have some partial results along these lines. We have a very nice result for W for AN. A nice result for F for AN. And I would say half a nice result or conjecture for the others. It's only a result for D4 in the other cases. It's a conjecture. You sort of have half a nice result. Another thing you can do, so there's this pursuing looking at other ADE cases, you can try and replace, as I mentioned before, you can try and replace UN with SPN or SON and see what happens. Again, it seems to be a fairly limited class of quivers to consider. And the last thing is this NF equals 2NC condition, which seems like an open question mark. Is this just an accident of our ansatz, or is it some more general statement? I mean, the relationships to 3+1 dimensional gauge theory, the vanishing of this NSBZ beta function seems suggestive. I don't know. So let me end there.
Do you understand why there should be an analogy with the Weyl character problem? I mean,
No.
Is it representation theory that you're doing?
It looks a bit like it. Yeah, you can. I'll tell you half the nice result. I'll tell you half the nice result. So, well, probably shouldn't have erased that. So F, this free energy, looks like 1 over root volume Y, the volume of this Trisasaki space. And if I write volume Y, I can write it as a rational function, some polynomial of the Chern-Simons levels divided by some other polynomial of the Chern-Simons. And the nice result is the following in general, or the conjecture. The conjecture is that this numerator, and this is due to Dan, who really at times seems rather magical in his ability to come up with answers to difficult questions. If I look at the roots in the lattice from one of these corresponding to one of these Dinkin diagrams, I can take a determinant of n of those roots, not just the simple roots, all the roots. Take some n of those, take a determinant squared, and then I take a product of a equals 1 to n of the root dotted into q. And what is q? Well, q is going to be related to the Chern-Simons levels. Q is going to be related to the Chern-Simons levels. It's going to be, so how does this work? K, Ka is alpha A dotted into Q. So this is basically just for the simple roots only. So this is a general root, that's a simple root. But this is sort of manifestly invariant under the action of the Weyl group. It's sort of a product, it's a sum, and the thing in the denominator looks like a product, so the sort of product divided by sum looks a bit like the Weyl character formula, but we don't know. But this is an interesting half result. I don't know how to write the denominator in an equally nice way.
Maybe we can keep staring at this one.